Zelenska. Next to me, she's a multidisciplinary, artist fascinated by visual narrative. Her primary media are paper and ink, manifesting as prints, comics, drawings, and publications. Her graphic novel, Back and Forth, a novel in 90 lino cuts, was nominated for the TCAF Doug Wright Award's Best Book in 2009. She's an art librarian at OCAD University, where she runs the Learning Zone, an experimental studio-based lettering space. Next to her, we have Dale Jacobs. He is an author of Graphic Encounters, Comics, and the Sponsorship of Multimodal Literacy. His previously published essays on comics include Multimodal Constructions Itself, Autobiographical Comics, and The Case of Joe Matt's Peep Show, which was published in Biography. He also wrote More Than Words, Comics as a Means of Teaching Multiple Literacies in English Journal. And he has two essays on comics and education coming out this spring, Web Comics, Multimodality, and Information Literacy, which is forthcoming in Image Text, and There Are No Rules There. And here they are, Scott McCloud's Making Comics as a Multimodal Rhetoric in the Journal of Teaching Writing. And we have Barbara Postuma, who holds a PhD from Michigan State University, an MA in Comparative Literature from the University of Warwick in the UK, and an MA in English Language and Literature from the University of Amsterdam. She's the author of Narrative Structure in Comics, Making Sense of Fragments, which is for sale out there. She's currently at the Modern Literature and Culture Research Center at Ryerson University, where she holds a postdoctoral fellowship and is working on her new scholarly book project, Telling Stories Without Words, Visual Communication in Silent Comics. And I'm Lindsay Gibb, and I'm one of the co-coordinators of this event, and I have a Master of Information from the University of Toronto, and I work with MARTA in the Learning Zone at the Ontario College of Art and Design. So, let's start by talking about all of your respective interests in comics and how they fit into the work that you do. Whoever wants to start.
I can start. So, obviously, my interest in comics comes from my interest as a creator, so maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. When I was growing up, I read a lot of Archie comics. They were obviously the most accessible things. They were in the supermarket. And in terms of comics that I feel are kind of focused towards a female audience, they're some of like the only comics you'll see unless you specifically go to a comic shop. My brother also inherited like these huge long boxes of Marvel comics. I think my dad bought some of them through Penny Saver. Sabers. So I read a lot of those and was always interested in comics, and always thought of myself as an artist and a writer, but didn't really think about making my own comics for a very, very long time. I'd say that when I started university, I started getting more into comics again, sort of the web comic scene, because that was really burgeoning. There was so much free comics available online, and you're in university and looking for something to procrastinate with. The internet is a great source. But I think a sort of turning point for me in terms of comics and what I envisioned comics could do was reading the book Epileptic by David Bee. There's something about, basically it's a comic about him and his family dealing with his brother's epilepsy. But the way that he translates that journey is really magical, and he uses a lot of like really rich visual metaphors. And I hadn't really seen that before, I think. I had seen comics that sort of, you know, here's the story, and here's real life, and even in more fantastical things, it's like, here's the fantastical context, but I hadn't really seen somebody sort of merge those two things together, so that was really exciting for me. And then when I was at the Ontario College of Art and Design, where I studied my undergrad, I took a course with George Walker, who is a bookmaker and a printmaker, and he has been working for a really long time in the tradition of the wordless woodcut novel, and he sort of inspired me to make my own book, so that was the book that I made. And then close to upon graduating my undergrad, I kind of knew that, you know, art wasn't going to make me money, and if it was, it would probably take a couple of years, and I'd have to pay the rent. So I had worked in libraries in high school, and I was fascinated by libraries, and then pursued that at a master's level, and then obviously hoped to apply all of my creative interests into my academic work as well. So I've been lucky enough that has happened for me. So I managed to be in library at OCAD. So we have zines of all different subject matters, but lots of comics, so small self-published kind of comics, the kind you'll see. So you can take off, and then I also order books for the graphic novel collection, which is awesome.
I guess like a lot of people, I read comics as a kid, sort of through undergraduate and then graduate school, took me away from them. And it wasn't until probably 2002, 2003, I was teaching a creative writing course at the University of Windsor, where I teach, and the students started giving me comics to read, graphic novels, and I started to see what they were doing, and after reading a lot, I started to think about ways in which I could take my interests from the composition of rhetoric and literacy and writing and autobiography and to think about comics in relation to those ideas. So especially, I guess a lot of the writing I've done has been about literacy and multimodal literacy, reading and writing using images and text and thinking about gestures and spatial elements, all of those things that you normally equate with a computer screen, at least in my field, that's how we talk about it. I started to think about, well, comics are another way we can talk about this. It's another in. And for a lot of classrooms, it's also a much less expensive way in to this idea of multimodal literacy. So a lot of what I've done has been along those lines. I've always had an interest in autobiography and history, so I've also done some writing and teaching in those areas as well. So I guess what I've come to be most interested in is how people read comics and make sense of comics texts as they read, and that's a continuing project.
I didn't stop reading comics when I was in college. I was always reading something, and comics were included in that. But my degrees were very English literature focused. So I did that for my BA and my MA, but then for my PhD, I wanted to do something that hadn't really been written about before. And I got It's a Good Life if You Don't Read It by Seth for my birthday, and I read that, and I thought, this is amazing. I want to find out how this book works. And that's what I didn't actually write my dissertation on It's a Good Life if You Don't Read It, and I don't think I even mentioned it, perhaps. But it's kind of what led me to that. So there, for my dissertation, I really wanted to think about how comics communicate, how the pictures work together, how the text and the images work together, how the story comes together from all these different bits and pieces. And now, with my postdoc, I don't know if I'm taking it a step further or a step back, but I'm looking at wordless comics because I think because they don't have text to fall back on, kind of foreground what's going on visually. You have to put the story together by just looking at the pictures. So that's both the history of them I find very interesting because they have been around as long as there have been comics, but especially how they do that formally. And there's quite a range of comics that do wordless stories. Especially now, actually, I keep finding more texts coming out of the woodwork. So it's a genre that seems to be very. There's a lot of interest in it just at the moment.
So how do you think comics are useful in an academic library or in a teaching setting?
Yeah, you can say. I like comics because they force you to be an active reader. Really have to pay attention to what's there, put things together, and so that foregrounds the act of interpretation. And I've not taught courses before that are just comics, but I always am able to incorporate at least a few, maybe a whole graphic novel and a couple of short stories or whatever. And I think it works really well by, you know, you can break down what's going on in a comic, and then students realize, like, oh, also do that with a chapter in a book or with a sentence even, and just see how these things are working together to create meaning. So I like them because of that, because it really inspires that activity on the part of the reader and the student.
I guess I've taught several comics-focused classes. I've done a rhetoric variety of things like that, educational comics, fiction, autobiography, so to try to get students to look at how comics can be used to communicate. I've taught a couple of fourth-year seminars on the graphic novel, so trying to get students to see it as literature, of course. I also taught a course focused in English on comics and multimodal literacy, so we have a lot of students who go on to do an education after a degree, so it was really working towards those students to get them thinking about literacy in more broad terms before they went to teacher's college. This fall, one of my colleagues and I are co-curating a comics art show next summer at our gallery in Windsor. So in the fall, I'm going to be teaching a comics theory course focused on how comics work, all the theories of how they work. And then in the spring, she'll be teaching a course, we have a course called Writing About the Arts. The students who take my course can then take her course, and they'll be helping us write all the didactic material for the exhibit, promotional material, etc. So we're trying to filter comics into some of the practical courses so students will get some experience in the world of teaching comics. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, at Windsor we have a very large graphic novels collection. Our library has been very supportive, and I'm quite active in helping to promote that and with the acquisitions of that collection. And that's fit in very well. It's some of the highest circulation books in our library.
Those classes
sound
great. I have to take one. So in terms of, I guess I can talk to speak a little bit to both. So obviously from the academic library perspective, in my context, I work at Okan University, which is primarily an art design institution, so obviously the supports a lot of the curriculum, but I would argue that even outside of an art and design institution, there's going to be comics or graphic novels in some course, so there's going to be comics in the collection are going to support curriculum. That's always sort of like the bottom line in terms of academic libraries. They enrich the collection, obviously. They represent a body of work that is really meaningful, powerful. They provide extracurricular reading for students, so that's pretty important in our library anyway. I think a lot of libraries have that mandate. We're supporting curriculum, but we also want the library to be a space that supports students in whatever kind of learning they want to do, whether it's classroom-based learning or outside. So, you know, ideation, kind of inspiration for studio work, that kind of thing. And then in general, I guess, comics support multiple literacies, so students who may not be so keen on reading a novel may find it a lot easier to read something using, you know, their stronger visual skills. Particularly at OCAD, we have a lot of students with, I think there's a correlation between artists and learning disabilities, so it's really great to be able to support students in that way. And then, kind of like what you said, graphic novels and comics often present this alternative presentation of identity or history or geography or gender or anything, so it's really great to have things in the collection that kind of go beyond mainstream ideas. I mean, in an academic context, we want to be pushing students to be thinking beyond what they've come in with. And then just all the different layers of meaning that comics can present and allow, like, opportunities for interpretation. You know, you can have comics where the image and text are going together, or where the image is going against the text, or there's something in the image that's happening completely independent of the text that you can sort of like clue in on. I think all of those are great reasons to comics in the library.
So speaking, I guess, to the whole idea that, you know, obviously an art institution would have probably had comics, but beyond that, do you think that they should be considered in other disciplines outside of art or English? Study and sort of how that should be.
I guess I can do history. I know that they sometimes do use texts like Real in their courses. Disability studies courses are starting to use them. I was in a panel this morning where someone talked about the spiral cage, but there's a lot of good self presentation of disability, so it's a good way to get at that idea instead of in position. But, you know, I think primarily at the secondary level it is in art and English that they have to be used.
Yeah, I think also education programs,
yes.
You know, also feeding back to first of all, I think some students are actually have a hard time reading comics. They're not used to it. And so for them to learn to read comics themselves and become facile reading comics and then knowing how to get other people to read them. So that's another area. I had worked on history as well. Possibly, I think it could fit in a film course as a contrast with the moving images, still images, and to see how to see some of the contrasts, and maybe some areas where people are working with creative text, primary text, but doing other kinds of studies with them, like communications or sociology or something like that. I don't think it, it'd have a very different focus from what we would do in English. And it might not be at all comics course, although it could be, of course, maybe about the comics industry. That could work in communications. To have a comic here and there to work with, I can see that.
Definitely when I was working at the library services department, there would be the odd university that, was like a science department looking for specifically science stuff, like journalism and literature science and stuff, things like that.
I was just going to add that, I think, like you're saying, for film, I think wordless comics would be especially useful, like the sort of analogy between wordless comics and silent film, I think is like very strong if you have like Lynn Ward and that kind of thing. I kind of sent out some feelers in terms of the faculty that teach using comics at my institution. A lot of them were art-based, so animation, illustration, comics kind of stuff. Intro to literature, art history, there's a contemporary East Asian art course that uses manga as part of it. And then there was one interesting class that was called Radical Graphics, the Culture of Protest. So that would probably be, social sciences or some kind of thing. So they use various different in there. And then I have a few other things like I wrote a list of recommended reading, but I don't know how whether anybody actually uses these, but there is right now there's just comics about everything, so they really could be applied to so many disciplines, like Logic Comics, which is a book by two Greek authors, which sort of follows the foundational quest of mathematics. There's a lot of like science based books. So I remember this summer I read one about evolution. Yeah, there's a lot of, and then like using Seth to look at Canadian studies, or The Arrival by Sean Tan, which is a wordless story about family immigrating. So I think there's, I think it really depends on the faculty member. If you really want to integrate comics into your classroom, then there's so much out there.
There'll be something
to really look at closely in.
So we often hear about comics such as Mouse or Persepolis being used in classrooms. Do you want to talk a little bit about what other types of, the other specific titles you think are useful? You have a list.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we hear about the same ones a lot, so,
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned The Arrival. I think that one is, it's a very, very rich text. So that could work in a number of settings. A couple of others that I wrote down is 100 Demons by Linda Barry, which is, it's short stories, wouldn't necessarily even have to teach the whole book, but it does come together nicely in a certain way as well. I've taught that in a women's writing course. It's also interesting because it plays with autobiography, partly autobiographical, partly fictional, and so it kind of pulls a little bit at those categories. And it's in a really, it's very simple style, I think deceptively simple, because it actually has a lot of depth, but it looks, it's very accessible, very almost childish. And I think, again, there you can show that this looks like, doodling, but there's actually so much going on in that book. So, 100 Demons, definitely. Joe Sacco, already mentioned, but his graphic journalism. And I was also thinking Red, a Haida manga by Michael Nicole Yamunas, in a Canadian literature course, for example, that would bring a really nice, different kind of text. Those are some of my suggestions.
texts that have worked well in the contemporary graphic novel course, Alison Bechtel's Fun Home, and a lot of other faculty members at our institution have taught it in other courses, autobiography courses, and contemporary lit courses. It teaches very well. Students like it a lot. It's very, very literary. The adaptation of City of Glass that Paul Karasek and David Mazzucchelli did is a great adaptation of the Paul Auster book, and it's a nice example of what comics can do and what they do differently than prose. I have so many, but just a couple more. Josh Neufeld's A.D. New Orleans After the Deluge is a great text, and it's particularly good because was done online serially first, and that version is still available. So if you want to, you can do it for no money for the students. And that version, it's great for teaching information literacy, actually, because there's so much extra information on the links within the text that you can wade through. But it's also an oral history, essentially. You interview a whole bunch of survivors, so you can think about how history works, about multiple perspectives on an event, etc. And then if you want, there's also a print version, so you can look at the differences in form between a webcomic and a print version of the comic. Those are all, I think, useful texts. Louis Riel, I mentioned before. Another, I think, really useful text is Miriam Catan's We Are On Our Own, which is a Holocaust memoir. It's a memoir about getting out of the Holocaust, escaping. So we always hear about Maus, of course, as that text, but I think Catan's book is great. It looks very unpolished. It's in pencil, heavy lines, but there's so much going on in that book. And another couple books, David Small Stitches, which is about disability and the medicalization of disability, is a great book, as is The Spiral Cage by Al Davison. And then the last one, just in terms of comics form, is David Mazzucchelli's A Mysterious Paula, which is a great book. Especially if you're teaching comics as literature, it's going to be a great book. And one final one that was just out this year, The Encyclopedia of Early Earth, which is a great, I would love to teach it, and if it finally comes out in paper, I'm going to, because it's a great way to bring in myth and to think about how myths work and how we use them in our lives and how they're used in fiction and all kinds of things. So I could go on with that.
So you took some of the ones off of my list, but that's okay. It's a long list. So I had already mentioned a couple before. In terms of sort of like political current events things and historical kind of discussions, I think there's a really great book called Best of Enemies by Jean-Pierre Foulou, illustrated by David B., which is basically the history of the conflict between the U.S. and the Middle East going back from 1783 to 1953. Provides a really great context. It's really well researched and provides a really great context for like contemporary things that are happening right now. How to Understand Israel in 60 Days or Less by Sarah Glidden is another one. She's Jewish and she goes on the birthright trip, and she has a like her boyfriend, she's like dating somebody who's, I don't think he's Muslim, but he's like Pakistani or something, and she has all these like really negative assumptions about what it's going to be like, and then it's obviously comes out to be a lot more complicated than that. So that's another one where there could be a lot of really great discussion fostered by it. Marzi by Marzia Masowa, which is all about Poland during the communist times, again another great historical kind of account. In terms of Alison Bechtel, Fun Home is a really great one, but I would also recommend Dykes to Watch Out For, which is a really big text of hers, a collection of her comic strip. A really great examination of like different kind of queer identities and kind of like really great character development and over time. Tech on Kid Creed by Matsumoto Tayo is an amazing book for just in terms of like a literature course. It's so complex and there's a lot of sort of really vague interpretation, so I think it could be a really great source of discussion. Jason is another artist who has multiple books who would be really great for that. There is a sort of ambiguity to his text that I think would inspire a lot of great discussion. Another book I would recommend is Meta Mouse, which is about mouse, but I usually don't really like reading books that are about the process of reading another book, but this was so rich, and what really spoke to me about it was you know, when it came out, it was really controversial. It was really, people were really up in arms about this serious topic with, like, you know, Mickey Mouse mice. That was, like, kind of what people were expecting out of it. And now we're at this point where graphic novels have saturated the culture so much that we forget how pivotal that book was. So maybe in, like, a comic studies class, that would be amazing. Chester Brown is paying for it. Again, another great source for discussion, sexual politics, maybe even law, legal things. Yeah, Joe Matt, exactly. And then looking at, like, Best American Comics, Hormone, sort of these collections could be another way of teaching a lot of different kinds of approaches to comics and just getting your students to buy one book. But talk to me later if you want more information.
So Marta, you mentioned wordless comics, and I know Barbara, you're studying that right now. So do you want to talk a bit about how you think wordless comics are useful in the academic pursuits?
I think I sort of mentioned this earlier, but because they absolutely force you to look at the pictures. In coming from English studies, I read a lot of work about comics where it comes down to kind of summarizing plot lines, and then the quotes will be from panels and captions, and the pictures are kind of taken for granted. And with the wordless comic, you don't have that to fall back on, so you're kind of forcing students to really engage with the visual storytelling. I don't think I've actually taught a wordless comic yet, so that I should do that and know what I know. I have specific examples that I can talk about then, but. In theory, I think that makes total sense to me, and that's what I find interesting about the form.
I guess I just want to say quickly that I agree with Barbara that it's form that, especially in English studies, the tendency is to focus just on words, and I always have to say to students, okay, it's not just the words. Comics is much more than how the panels work, it's how the page is laid out, it's how the visuals work. All these things, so wordless comics get them to focus on all of those other elements. One of the exercises I use, I haven't done it with wordless comics, but it might work well, and this is a way to get students into the library too, is for every comics course I teach, the first assignment is you have to go into the library, you have to explore the graphic novels collection, find a page or two-page spread you like, photocopy it, blow it up, and then you have to explain how to read that page or those pages, using whatever theories we've read that semester, and explain how gutters work, explain how the visuals work, explain the relationship between text and image. All of these things would make them focus on the form, and also to make them use that collection.
Yeah, I don't know if I have too much to add to that. I guess, like, wordless comics, there is a tendency, somewhat of a tendency, to sort of deal with more universal themes, I guess, because there's the whole factor that someone needs to, you're creating something, or I have made wordless comics, so I'm speaking from my own perspective, but, you know, you're creating something that, I always think about, when I was in university, something that I really loved reading was The Death of the Author by Roland Barthes. You know, that whole concept of, like, the death of the author is the birth of the reader. You know, the author no longer has this one particular interpretation that they're writing with. It's really readers coming in with all their different, own creative interpretations of the story, and I think wordless comics are really, like, an amazing way of illustrating that. So if you're creating comics, you know, you might have a particular intention in mind for how the story is going to be interpreted, so you really have to think about, like, simplifying and, like, making the story as relatable as possible so it's closely interpreted to what you want. And yeah, like you said, form, you become so dependent on, you know, the vantage point of the characters, sequence, composition, pattern, all this kind of stuff, to indicate who someone is and what's happening.
One thing I like about wordless as well is that sometimes you can't even tell if characters are male or female. When you're reading text, it's always he, she, you can't get away from that. But with wordless, you know, a lot of these stories have animal characters. Sometimes you can tell from the dress, but sometimes they don't even have clothes on. So you can then, I guess you can, you do have that power then to interpret that as you want. Like, well, I want this dog to be a girl, go for it. And someone else may choose to have it be a boy, that's fine too, but there's, I guess there is sort of an empowerment there that you really are part of that interpretation process, that you can sense very, very directly.
The other talks during this period are about activities that you can do with teens and kids to get them using the collection, and you were talking a bit about one project. Is there other suggestions of just active things that you can get people doing with comics?
That's one I always do. I direct the first year writing program, so I have graduate students teach for me, and we have students write that. One genre is a public service announcement. That's the one where we get composed in multiple modes. You have to use, you know, audio, visual, all these different possibilities you have. And one of the ways in we use is comics, is one-page PSA comics. Sometimes we read something from an old DC comic or whatever, but use that as a way in, get them to read it and think about how they're getting information additively as they go through. So how do they read it, and then how does that translate into how you can convey your own message, whatever your PSA is, have them try to do one in a comics form, even with stick figures or whatever, or software that uses photographs, as a springboard into thinking about what are the possibilities for billboards or script for a television commercial or whatever it happens to be, but to get them to move from reading comics to composing comics or thinking about how they might use the affordances of comics to say something.
One assignment that I've just found out about, I haven't tried it yet, it's sort of a variation of what you're saying, it's a tracing assignment.
Right.
So you take a page and put tracing paper, and then, so students have to trace elements in the page and then write next to them what's happening there. Do you go this way or that way to read something? What elements, visual elements, are jumping out? How does that change your interpretation? And that, I think one of the benefits of having tracing paper is that you can actually have them, they may actually do several layers from the first quick scan of a page to reading it more carefully and then finding something else. And another assignment that I want to use in my next class is having students find, I guess I can send them to the library and maybe use a collection for that, but have them find a page transition that where they have to find a moment where on the, what is it, the recto page, and there's some kind of cliffhanger, and then you turn the page and it, you know, something changes or doesn't turn out what you want, what you thought it was going to be, or actually it completely shows what you thought it was going to be. You were kind of calling that the setup and the reveal.
Yes.
So again, to really think about what the form does and how the material qualities of the book there are really guiding your reading as well. The fact that there is something hidden, that it's purposefully something that you have to kind of anticipate and then find out what happens.
So, as educators, how much are you working directly with the library and the comics collection and libraries that you work in?
I have lots of library books on my shelf. So I use the collection.
Sure, just for yourself, but I mean, like,
yeah.
Engaging you with the
We use it all the time. That's consciously why it's there. And I work in conjunction with the library and buys for that collection. A lot of times she says, just give me a list of books that you think. And we try to have, you know, a variety of things. There's manga, and there's European comics, and it's more translated. There's more of those. There's comics for kids. There's, we try to have as big a selection as we can. things you can have students do for the comics courses I teach, I give students the option to write their final paper as a comic. Not too many take me up on it, but in the, I guess I've taught four comics courses, I've probably had three people do it. And they, at the end of it, they say, this was so much more invariably. But, you know, for example, right now, Nick Susanis is doing his PhD, his dissertation as a comic. So more and more we have people in academics using the comics form to convey information and get ideas. So I think we can, that's one of the things we can use to encourage students to do that.
Do you have a sense of how much the instructors at OCAD are using?
Yeah, so I tried to reach out to some people before this panel because I don't teach, so I wanted to have some something to say at this panel. So I know that, so the instructors who teach the graphic novel or the comics courses, they definitely tell their students to use the collection. They pull things from the collection and use it in the classroom. So, you know, they'll read comics in class and like a slideshow from scans, kind of panel by panel, kind of separating them out. One of our instructors was telling me that he really tries to push his students to read one comic that's outside of their comfort zone during the course, which is kind of interesting. And then I've also kind of sent out a thing on Facebook to, like, the students to see what kind of things they had learned. So I know that, you know, in a kind of character design course, if they had looked at sort of character design within a comic or even just a kind of intro to drawing class, they were assigned to do a comic and post it online every week for that particular class. So I think it really depends on the faculty. I definitely try to reach out to the faculty that I know are using comics whenever I'm doing a big purchase to sort of see, touch base with them to see if there's anything that we're missing. So that's one of my collection building strategies.
Is there a comics course?
There's a few. There's a graphic novels illustration class. But there's, I'm not sure what all of them are called. I didn't have time to look that up. But yeah, there's several. I think most of them are based in the illustration course. But then we also have, in our printmaking course, we have, what is it called? It's basically sort of like a self-publishing, it's called nano-publishing, so like small press kind of self-publishing zines. So there's comics that come out of that as well.
Yeah, and the liberal arts, there's also a comics
course. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this may be mostly for Marta, but how do you decide on the scope of your collection? Like whether it's representative or if it's going to be fuller, or like what it focuses on?
Yeah, so I guess it probably depends on the institution and the library and what kind of students they're serving. We're basically serving the whole school. We only have one library at OCAD. And there's a limit to how many comics we can buy, and there's a limit to how many comics we can store in the library. So I think initially when the collection was started, it was started with some help from Bugaila. It was before my time, so they kind of had a core amount. And we basically focus on graphic novels, sort of like, you know, bound books rather than issues. We don't really collect any issues of anything. In general, we don't really also collect trades of serialized publications unless they're really huge and critically acclaimed. Just because when you get into serial publications, it's kind of like a huge can of worms, so you kind of have to set parameters. So we've chosen not to go there. So a lot of them are kind of either one-off stories. Some of them are multi-volume collections. There's anthologies. But I kind of go through, and each time I buy things throughout the year, but I usually make one or two big orders throughout the year, so I try to have a particular focus for each of those orders. So I think the first big one I did was a really strong focus on Canadian comics, so trying to have a really representational Canadian comics collection. Then the next one was branching out to more international. There's a lot of great Japanese and French comics. All of our collections in English, though, so we're limited by that language. I think we have one thing that's German, but it's mostly wordless, so kind of slip that in there. And then in the most recent time, I bought a lot of like historical newspaper comics. There's these really great artist editions, which are like these huge reprints of the original artwork. So kind of looking back on that. Yeah. But it really depends. Like, I know that primarily I'm collecting for students who want to read these as an extracurricular thing and students who are primarily interested in it as creators. So I'm looking at, you know, visually interesting and unique examples that are really experimenting with formal aspects, and then a few of those anthologies like Best American Comics, Mo, other stuff like that, that I know there's going to be a sampling. So even if I can't afford or I can't find a book by one particular artist, I can at least have that artist represented in the collection.
Do you have a sense of what's happening in your institution?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The collection at Letty is the same. We don't buy floppies at all. There's no way to store them. It's primarily the same. We do buy more collections in volume. So things like BMZ, we have all of them, or Y, The Last Man. But we're careful about which we buy. We have quite a bit of superhero stuff. Not a ton, but there's quite a bit of Batman stuff. Because there's another prof who actually teaches a superheroes course, so have material for that. We try to buy most of the comics criticism that comes out, all the University of Mississippi stuff, variety of other presses. For a while the budget could sustain it, we had a standing order with John Court with everything they published, which we can't anymore, of course. But again, we try to have the breadth of the form represented, so there's quite a few collections. We have the Legal and Slumberland, we have the big Sunday edition. We have, you know, as much of that as we can, and some superhero stuff, and some manga, and some European material, and lots of graphic novels. We have a lot of autobiographies. We have several professors who teach autobiography and use those books. So we try to get material that's directed at comic studies courses. We get that regularly, teach them material that other profs will use, material that students will take out of the library. So, and again, we've been lucky that there's been money, and the library's been very good about maintaining that collection. They're happy with it because it gets checked out. Unlike, you know, sometimes books get bought, of course, and checked out. They can show the circulation stats, and it's always positive.
I'm just going to add one other thing that I try to take into consideration is buying things that the library could afford, but students probably couldn't.
Right.
So some of those really big newspaper collections, Kramer's Ergot sometimes, you know, like Building Stories, sort of like artist editions, like kind of trying to provide access to things that students otherwise would not be able to have access to.
Yeah, and that goes for criticism as well, which is often quite expensive. That's what I, at Ryerson, they don't have a huge collection of graphic novel and comics related stuff. So what I usually tell them, I ask them to buy is criticism, just so I know that I can send students to go read articles in there. They have online subscription so that we have access to the International Journal of Comic Art as well, and one or two other journals. And for actual comics, I often tell students to go to the Toronto Public Library because they actually have, you know, it's spread out over all the different places, but you can get holes and it comes right to your branch, so that's actually a really useful resource to find.
So we're nearing the end of the time. Does anybody have questions? I see your hand already.
I just want to pick up what Marv was saying about active learning and how there are things which are intrinsic to the experience of reading a comic. We were talking about this, about how the setup and the reveal is the fact that you're holding a physical artifact in your hands and you turn a page and something happens. And of course, all the action is actually taking place between the panels, so the gutters are critically important to, you know, it's like that kind of persistence of vision or persistence of perception, the whole system of the story. That's not what I wanted to ask. By the nature of us being here, we're reinforcing what we know and in some ways preaching the choir. The challenge, I think, is when we go to our academic institutions, and we've experienced this when we first took our program to Camosun, was the pushback that we got. We were originally embedded in the English department, and the pushback that we got was not insubstantial from some teachers who said, well, wait a minute, this is literature that we teach here, and we have comic books, so you got to read it. So I want to get your feedback, perhaps, on what do you do when you start feeling that?
guess I've been lucky because at Windsor I've had virtually no pushback. In fact, from some of the older faculty, I thought there would be. It was a complete embrace of it. I think because they understand it in terms of things like artist books, things that they know about. But a lot of the faculty have started using any one graphic novel, of course. Our chair, who I thought would be very resistant, our new chair, asked me if I would teach a second year comics course because of the draw I was just using. And no resistance at all. In fact, embracing it. So at least at our campus, there hasn't been that kind of resistance to it. But I have heard that from other colleagues trying to teach it. And I guess the approach I would have is to just try to show them this is not this ghettoized art forming. Look at the newspapers that review comics. Look at comics come through it is. And you get the Globe and Mail, the New York Times, and the New Yorker, Time Literary Supplement reviewing comics. Why are they not viewed as literature?
That hadn't been said. We were talking about this over lunch, and Scott Chandler's Two Generals came up 2 years ago. One of the mainstream papers, I don't know if it was the Globe or the National Post, the reviewer actually said, wow, this is amazing. A serious subject like World War II discussing what is essentially a comic book. And I thought, didn't his editor tell him that 15 years ago Art School won a Pulitzer for what was a comic book? I mean, right. You know, every time you think that, okay, well, that conversation's over, it rears its ugly head again. So I think we still have quite a ways to go.
I think a really great way of, like, motivating institutions is to pit them against other institutions, honestly. It's like, comics studies has kind of become the norm in a lot of schools. So you could say, you could use this whole, like, newspapers and the whole critical approach to it, but you could also even just look at other universities, look at what courses they're teaching, pull up some syllabuses, and say, hey, all these kids at Yale, they have a comic studies class, basically shaming your institution. Very effective strategy. I didn't say that, Like you're saying, you have, multiple comic studies courses, we have comics courses, I think comparing is...
Shaming,
basically. Very effective tool in society. Yeah. There's more
there's more, I think, for one thing, more comics that are actually being written specifically for children, so also from a pedagogical point of view. So I think there's a lot of kind of cross-pollination possible there.
The article that I wrote a few years ago, More Than Words, it was in the English Journal, which is a K-12, for K-12 teachers, and in it I talk about Ted Nafee's Pauline the Pirates, which it's a comic, but I mean, it operates very close to the way it operates, although it's multiple panels on a page instead of one page, but the ideas about Irene are very similar. And so these fights about, it's not a comic, it's a picture book, it's not a picture book, it's a comic, seem odd to me. And if people in comics do it, and I see people in children's lit doing it too, it's, I don't understand.
There's a really great book that came out in the past couple of years. I'm not sure exactly. I think the name is just Children's Picture Books. It's like a yellow cover with a little girl laying down reading a book. And for the first half of it is very much looking at like the theory of picture books and like all these different elements of how they function. And then the second half of it is sort of looking at kind of contemporary people working in the field. And as I was reading that, I was just like furiously taking notes because basically everything in there applied to comics. So it really just breaks down to visual storytelling, sequential art, and, you know, I think it's children's picture books. I can, you know,
it's Martin something, right?
Okay.
It's a big book.
Yeah, it's like this big.
It's yellow. I don't know.
It's yellow. It's yellow, guys.
It's yellow.
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 Go to your library. It's a pretty yellow one. It's going to go over really well.
Marta sent me.
Great. Well, I want to thank Marta and Dale and Barbara for being with us today. We have one more session this afternoon in here. It's going to be an adult book talk. In the front, I think it's kids book talk, and back there is a teen book talk. And I think you put your names in for a draw when you came in here, so the draw is going to happen like during the talks, the book talks. So stick around.